It's really just, you know, trying to point us to what's very natural to us, to be aware and to have it not be so limited. Because we don't maybe appreciate how conditioned we are to think of mind as being in our head. There's never been a mind found in the head. That is, it's an idea that because it's so practiced, it reinforces the sense of being separate, apart from, and often apart, just feeling like you're apart from the flow of life, and everything's out there and I'm in here. And some of that is appropriate, to have appropriate sense of individuality. We have individual bodies, but the view that our mind is in our head, and two, that it's a thing that has an inside and an outside, that's all just made up. Everything is mind. Anything that can be noticed. I'm in your mind right now. Please.
I don't have a mic, is it okay?
I will repeat what you say. The combination of the sound
and the visuals,
and
especially of my sensations being stars.
Yes, the experience of the sensations being like stars.
Caused me just to feel immense love.
Caused her to feel immense love. Thank you. And, you know, all of this is an invitation to experience ourselves outside of our usual conceptual limitations. We don't sometimes appreciate how much the concepts, the way we think about things, limits the way that we can be free. So this is just a taste, and it's not something to aim for, because then you're busy being a little person aiming at a big experience. We don't need that. But just to, whenever you feel to refer to that, just as one of my teachers said, unfurl your mind. Just be open. And just remember, for those of you who are new to this, those who've sat with me before know I repeat this every time, is our mind is not the sky. The sky is not the sky. That's another idea. But our mind is sky-like in its impartiality. You know, it just, sky isn't busy saying, you can be there, you can't be there, you should be there, you shouldn't be there. You're okay, you're not okay. It meets everything equally. So in that way, our mind can mirror the impartiality of the sky, the welcoming quality, the open quality. But our mind is, at least to my experience of just the juiciness of being with you, our mind is so much more filled with intelligence and love and discernment. You know, and it's out of that kind of openness that we know that we're not alone. We're not just in that little bubble of our own individuality, that we're so connected to one another. But there are different, many metaphors used for the nature of our heart, mind, and you know, your national treasure, Leonard Cohen, spelled wrong. But he uses the metaphor of the ocean. He says, if you don't become the ocean, you'll be seasick every day. Yeah, so. Then there's lucid like a crystal, shining like a flame, unshakable like a mountain. So many different metaphors used, and you can use different metaphors to help you rest in a non-reactive noticing. Any other comments about it? Please.
For me, the contrast between the bells and particularly the silence was the
contrast between the bells and the silence.
The silence was really the revelation, because we were, if something came up in the mind, and I was aware of it at that point.
Yes. If something came up in the mind, you were aware of it.
Uh-huh. Then I knew that it wasn't silent.
Then you knew it wasn't silence, right. Yeah. Interesting. Thank you. Anybody else over here? Any comments? Any Zoom comments?
A comment from the chat. At some point, I was aware that I had been off in some other world until I had suddenly connected to your words, which brought me to a different aware state. Also, I found I had thoughts on the fringes of the sky, but I could not identify any particular thoughts, and they did not stick with me.
Marvelous. What I'm gathering from what you said in your note is that there was a lot of continuity of awareness, and that so many things that were noticed, and that's really the key here, is that we show up, and that it shouldn't look a certain way, or any, there's no special experience. It's whatever it is that's noticed. And then part of mindfulness is knowing when you are present, and then knowing when you have been absent. so that's part of our understanding of the dance of mind. Here, there's a beautiful quote from Anam Thubten, a wonderful Tibetan teacher. He was our guest teacher for the Spirit Rock Teacher Retreat this last September, and it was just marvelous being with him. He says, "You are consciousness, and so am I. Consciousness is said to be groundless because it has no size, no color, shape, or location. Some people think that consciousness is living in us. However, such a view is very limited in scope since this consciousness is all-pervading. We live in it. We are it. It enjoys eternal play. Now and then consciousness forgets that its play is its own manifestation and gets lost in believing that it is separate from itself. That forgetfulness is the fundamental delusion that gives birth to all troubles, problems, struggles, and unending chain reactions. Since consciousness itself is not separate from enlightenment, consciousness being aware of itself can happen suddenly and break the chain created by our forgetfulness." So if that may be meaningful, maybe just words, but however it is that you take it. I think that leads me to the few minutes that I have. You know, there are three character types that reflect what the Buddha described as the three root causes of suffering in our lives as individuals. Those three root causes of suffering are grasping or greed in the mind, aversion or hatred in the mind, and delusion. Greed, hatred, delusion. And there are three character types that seem to express one of those. And I would call myself a grasping type, a greed type. And part of a greed type, being a greed type, is I want, not only do I want everything, but I want to share everything. So I can be a little too ambitious about what I offer. But I really wanted to offer a little bit, because I only have a little bit of time, a little bit of what really motivated me to choose the topic of the wings of awakening, wisdom and love. And I talked a little bit yesterday about the sense I have that the most loving thing that we can do in our life is to be wise. The most loving thing you can do is to find for yourself and find for yourself and the world what it is that causes you to spin in a world of stress. And what is it that will liberate you from that stress And the, of course, the expression of being liberated from stress is that then you're free to be of some use and benefit to others, to the people who have to live around you and all beings everywhere. So anything that we can do to loosen our hearts, that's about as loving as we can do for ourselves, is to free ourselves. And the Buddha was very, very specific about what he thought from his own discovery, what he thought would really liberate our hearts from confusion. So this is the wisdom part. He said there's basically four things that you need to navigate. I could pick any list. It's all a hologram, so it all connects to each other. But I'll just stick with a moment with the teaching on the Four Noble Truths that is really can be reduced to if holding on and grasping causes stress, if this causes this, then if you remove the cause, you don't get this. You get release. So the whole idea is to remove the cause of stress. It's very simple. If this causes this, you remove this, you don't get this. Your hand is open. But the way that he encouraged us to release ourselves and each other from the bounds of tension was to, of all things, to say, it's important that you turn toward and see clearly that the definition of birth, in other words, it's natural. The definition of birth is the leading cause of death. The definition of birth is the leading cause of all kinds of things that are hard to bear. This is not an aberration. This is just the way it is. Nothing, I'm not saying anything new. But rather than being in contention with this fact, it's important that we turn toward it, that we welcome it, that we don't compound it by being so reactive to these basic things, and don't try to run from it, but find some peace right in the middle of it, to normalize it, in other words. And he described and encouraged us all to recognize that what turns the basic dukkha, the basic stress, the basic unsatisfactoriness, the basic hard to bear, the basic challenge of just being alive and dealing with all that it means to be alive, what turns that basic dukkha into mental dukkha, into mental suffering? In other words, what compounds our stress is this chronic tendency to want it to be other than the way it is. And then that wanting it to be the way it is, the Buddha recommended that we let go of that, that we abandon that cause. We release that reactivity to the experiences that we have. And then to experience for ourselves, what's it like to let go? What's it like? And that freedom is really possible. That it is possible to feel the letting go of that tight fist of grasping, to let go of trying to hold on to things, to the idea of that it shouldn't be this way. And to cultivate the path, which means to cultivate using the moments of your own life to cultivate the conditions that help you let go, that help you feel less bound in reactivity. And that means to, at the center of it all, to practice attention, because every moment of attention is a moment that is free of reactivity. It's free of greed, free of hatred, free of delusion. Because you can't have a moment of attention and have reactivity in the same instant. You can't. Basically erases a little bit of our conditioning. Every moment of attention. So at the center of it is mindful attention. But it's embellished with care, with our actions of body, speech, and mind. We talked about that the first night, the first day, the precepts, non-harming, so that our mind is not reverberating so much from the effects of our action. And we're not internally struggling with having said things that harm ourselves or others internally or externally, clouded our perception with intoxicants, fed actions that are hurtful and harmful. You know, all the things that actually exacerbate our stress. Instead, we learn to live what the Buddha described as blamelessly, to experience the bliss of blamelessness. And then to understand, part of the path with mindfulness at the center is to understand just what I talked about, to understand, yeah, that life has things that are hard to bear. And I can see for myself in my mind what adds to my stress, what causes stress is I'm resisting this experience or I'm wanting something to be otherwise. And I'm spending a lot of my time planning what's next, trying to become something, trying to get away from this beautiful unfolding reality. And that's keeping me bound on a cycle of dissatisfaction. And interestingly enough, because I'm cultivating the path, I'm seeing moment to moment what's going on here. And we're all cultivating the path. And just like the Buddha did, the more he paid attention, the stronger his attention got, the stronger his mindfulness and concentration, which are elements of the Eightfold Path. And with that, his mind became brighter and brighter. In other words, the dust of memory cleared, and his mind became really clear. And he was able to see that whatever's coming is going. Whatever arises fades away. Are you interested in this part? Whatever arises fades away. And then it became obvious that that which notices, the consciousness that arises with each experience is also coming and going. How's that? And it became clear that everything was arising and fading, and it wasn't arising and fading to someone. That it was just selflessly coming. It was just coming and going. And it became so obvious that if everything is in a state of flux and there's holding, you're trying to hold the river, it creates tension. So the more that impermanence and change became the Buddha's guru, teacher, the more it was just a natural letting go. And as there was more letting go, it became absurd to try to hold on to what he called the pride and enchantment with youth, the pride and enchantment with health, the pride and enchantment with life even. The more could see the futility of that kind of those three prides, something in him relaxed. And in a flash of insight, when he saw that there was nothing in this world of change that could be clung to and held on to, that could give lasting happiness, something in his being relaxed, and in a flash of insight, he realized that the freedom, the relief that he had been looking for in changing conditions, in identities, in views, opinions, in positions, in things, in people, in situations, that the expected, the hope for relief that he had been searching for was found not in those changing conditions, but in the natural state of his own heart. He realized, as Anantuktam was saying, he realized he was consciousness, groundless, without size or shape or color or form, that our own mind is intrinsically free, but it, in its eternal play, it forgets itself and gets carried away in an imaginary version of ourselves that it emerges and gets connected to a body that's changing. And so the identity that emerges in that eternal play, called you, the body that emerges and becomes the primary identity, not very reliable because it's changing. The roles that we play, the cultural identities that we hold, not very reliable, because someone either someone values it and someone doesn't. Our roles, like I said, our roles, the identity that emerges in the eternal play, for me to take this role, not a very reliable identity. I know I've talked about it here in Victoria. As our friend just south of the border, Bonnie Durant, says, you know, here I'm the sage on the stage, but then I go home. And as I tell everyone, my wife does not want a guru at home. So that identity, not very reliable. So identity with, an identity with becoming someone, that's a kind of stress that causes us so much worry, and because our the pinnacle where we're aiming, where we want to become, takes place in a future that's imaginary and it never really arrives. And so our mind and body are often in a state of postponement, in a state of suspended happiness, waiting for to become healed, become better, become best, caught in a chronic comparing mind with some ideal or someone else. And that's stressful. It's painful. And then what do we do when we realize that our identities are built on an idea and on things that are fragile and unreliable? These bodies and our moods and our minds and our roles and our religions and our education and our wealth. And what do we do when we realize that it's unsatisfactory, unreliable? We judge ourselves. We think something's wrong with us. We think that everyone else is happy except us. And if only I was different, then I would become okay. And that's why when the Buddha saw through that illusion of a independent self-existence, he saw that that way that we react to sense experience and then get triggered this whole chain of reactions, that then we live in this kind of dream of that future that never arrives. It's spoken beautifully by a teacher named Dujin Rinpoche, where he says, isn't it true that after your last thought has ceased and before the next one arises, Is there not a vivid clarity without anything special to see? It's just we're naturally clear, open. And he says, ho, that means how amazing. This is awareness. He says, but isn't it also true that a thought suddenly arises? Now, if that thought is noticed, it's just an expression of awareness, no problem at all. Thoughts are to, like I said today, thoughts are to our mind like a sound is to you. It's natural. But if that thought goes unnoticed, it spreads out into ordinary thinking. And he calls that the chain of delusion. Because what happens in that little chain of delusion? We incarnate in a little dreamscape, a virtual version of ourselves. And the thought of ourselves, the story of ourselves, that has a certain kind of historical truth to it. But the thought of ourselves is, I've come from the past and I'm passing through here on my way to being happy in the future. Even though that's an imaginary you, and the future is imaginary, and so is the past. There's just this. And so that as long as I'm caught in that chain of delusion, and I'm associating my well-being with what's next instead of right here, I'm often feeling very vulnerable and very insecure. Because why? Because my happiness is not Tarangaroway. My happiness is what's next, and I don't know what's next. And so there's a lot of uncertainty about whether I'll ever get there. And there's no there anyway. So that's why when the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree and awakened to the realized that the unborn, the unconditioned, was the natural state of his own mind. He let out a song. And he said, through many births in this wandering on, lifetime after lifetime of going through this cycle of becoming, what's called bhava, says, through many births in the wandering on, I ran, seeking but not finding the maker of this house. O house builder, you've been seen now. You won't, but you shall not build a house again. I like to add to it, you won't build a house again and be oblivious to it. Your rafters are broken. That means the defilements of mind. Your ridgepole destroyed. The root ignorance is destroyed. The mistaken view that you are that one who has come from the past and going to the future. My mind gone to the unconditioned, to cravings cessation. I'm no longer fighting with reality. Peace has come. So that's great for the Buddha, but all of us, all of us are entrained in this samsaric. Samsara means endless wandering. We're trained in the fragility of the excessive identity with our body and our minds and where we're going and where we've been. That's kind of the world that we live in. And then we wonder why we feel so insecure. And what we tend to do in the face of that is we tend to beat ourselves up, be harder on ourselves. That's why when you see with wisdom, the wisest thing you can do when you see yourself through the eyes of wisdom is to be loving and merciful, is to be kind, is to have a compassionate response to the fragility of this life and this body, and look what we have to deal with. The whole world is a manifestation of that, the case of mistaken identity and searching, looking for love in all the wrong places. And it's simplistic to say, you know, just to reduce it to that when you see the reality of war, that the implications are huge. But it starts, the seed is in that basic misunderstanding of who and what we are. That each of us, in our own way, can, together I should say, not in our own way, but together, alone together, each of us can see through that illusion of self, of that separate imaginary self. And the implications of that is when we see through the illusion of self, we see through the illusion of other, that there, we come to that understanding that we're all in this together. And we're not as separate. It's not just about us. And freed of that preoccupation with me and what I want to happen and what I hope will happen, we, as a beautiful, funny poem from David Budbill, is that his name? It's called Bugs in a Bowl. He says, we're all just like bugs in a bowl, all day going around our bowl, climbing up the steep sides, falling back, head in our hands, cry, moan, feel sorry for ourselves, or look around. See your fellow bugs. Say, how you doing? Say, nice bowl. Untangling the tangle so we can actually connect with each other. And that's really one of the beautiful things of coming together in our practice period, is we, little in moments at a time, we come out of the tangle of our own, we use the material of our own confusion as our path. We let it call us here and remind us of our love of just being right here in this moment, letting go moment to moment to that tight grasping habit and replacing it with openness. And you can feel it. You can feel the intimacy that grows in the silence. So the most loving thing that you can do is become wise. The wisest thing you can do is become loving. First, as the Buddha recommended, first and foremost with yourself. He said you could scan the world in all directions and not find anyone more deserving of loving kindness. And many people thank you for confessing innocently how hard you are on yourself. I'm useless, I can't do this, I'm not enough. Well, all different versions. And of course, once we're in that cycle, we actually, our identity just keeps getting reconstructed again and again as someone with a problem to solve. And where is that someone right now with a problem to solve if you don't consult your memory? As one of my teachers said, you need the past and thoughts to suffer. You don't need anything to be free. So check it out. Anyway, may we all grow in love, mercy, compassion. May we all grow in wisdom. And may our practice together today and every day and all the fruits of our practice be shared, be dedicated to the welfare and benefit of each other and all beings, and maybe bring a special blessing to the people in all the different wars right now, the innocent people who want the same happiness that you and I want, who are in harm's way, and even the perpetrators who just haven't been able to break that cycle of the victim and perpetrator. May all beings be touched by love. May all beings awaken to the sacred happiness that's without sorrow here and now. May all beings be liberated. Okay, thank you so much for your practice. It came a little too fast for me, I have to admit. I'm a little feeling a little sad right now that we have to stop. You're probably anxious to get out the door, but I'm sure there's that's okay too. I can handle it. It is all about me, you know.